Before the throne of God above.
Hello and welcome to Sovereign Grace Today. I'm Michael Goins. We are currently involved in an exposition of 1 Corinthians. If you have access to a Bible, open with us to that New Testament epistle and stay tuned for today's message.
My name is written on his heart. I know that while in him he stands, no tongue can bid me thirsty part.
On today's edition of Sovereign Grace Today, we continue our verse-by-verse exposition of 1 Corinthians. And we're in chapter 7 today. And the topic of our study is Biblical Counsel Concerning Marriage. This is, again, a very practical section of the epistle, and the apostle is going to address a situation at the church at Corinth, but it's a relevant situation for us as well in the modern world. Stay tuned for part one of the message today.
God has not promised, God's always blue. Flowers from
continue our verse-by-verse study through 1 Corinthians this morning by reading in the 7th chapter, beginning in verse number 1. Now concerning the things whereof ye wrote unto me, says Paul, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. The wife hath not power of her own body, but the husband, and likewise also the husband hath not power of his own body, but the wife. Defraud ye not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. But I speak this by permission and not of commandment, for I would that all men were even as I myself, but every man hath his proper gift of God, one after this manner and another after that. I say therefore to the unmarried and widows, it is good for them if they abide even as I. But if they cannot contain, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn. And unto the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord, let not the wife depart from her husband, but, and if she depart, let her remain unmarried, or be reconciled to her husband, and let not the husband put away his wife. But to the rest speak I, not the Lord. If any brother hath a wife that believeth not, and she be pleased to dwell with him, let him not put her away. And the woman which hath a husband that believeth not, and if he be pleased to dwell with her, let her not leave him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Else were your children unclean, but now are they holy. But if the unbelieving depart, let him depart. A brother or a sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God hath called us to peace. Without a doubt, one of the devil's primary targets in his assault on the lives of believers is the marriage relationship. I believe if the devil can drive a wedge between husband and wife, if he can divide the team and make the husband or the wife act independently of the other, if he can put asunder what God hath joined together and separate husband from wife, then he scored a significant victory in his war against Jesus Christ and his church. That was precisely his tactic in the Garden of Eden when he tempted Eve to act independently of her husband, Adam. And I dare say it is still his tactic today to drive a wedge of separation. He wants to divide what God has joined together. In this seventh chapter of 1 Corinthians, we have an entire chapter devoted to the often controversial yet very contemporary subject of divorce and remarriage, and especially marriage and singleness. Now, I'm aware that this is a sensitive subject. Rare is the family that has not felt the pain and heartache of a broken relationship, either in the immediate family or in the extended family. I'm sure that all of us have been touched at one level or another. But this isn't a new problem. It's a problem that troubled the church at Corinth in the first century, and for which they wrote to Paul for advice. In fact, speaking of the laissez-faire attitude that people had in the Greco-Roman world in the first century, the philosopher Seneca said, "They marry in order to divorce. They divorce in order to remarry." Sounds like the modern world in which we live, does it not? So this was a problem that they faced. And I think it will help us to be familiar with what God's Word has to say about this very important subject. And this entire chapter is devoted to this very important subject. Now notice in the first verse, Paul says, "Now concerning the things whereof ye wrote unto me." And apparently Paul now is going to devote the rest of his energies in this letter to answering specific questions that the Corinthians had asked him. Now, we've already studied through six chapters in this book, and we've already heard Paul address a number of issues that were troubling the church at Corinth. But apparently they had written him a letter asking for advice on specific questions. Some of those specific questions were the question of marriage and divorce. Another, in the eighth chapter that Paul is going to address, was the issue of Christian liberty. They had some questions about whether it was right to eat meat that had been sacrificed to idols or not. Some said yes, and others said no. Some said, "That offends my conscience that you would do that," and others said, "We're free in Christ to do as we please." So they had some conflict over issues of Christian liberty, and they specifically addressed a letter to Paul asking for feedback on that issue. And then another question they had had to do with the use of spiritual gifts. And Paul is going to devote a good bit of effort and time and energy to addressing those questions in chapters 12 through 14 in 1 Corinthians. But this chapter begins the section now in which Paul addresses the specific questions that they had raised. "Now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me." And here's number one on the list. They had some questions about how Christians should view the subject of marriage and divorce and remarriage. We have questions about that, don't we, today? I know that, again, that all of us have sensitive spots, you know, like a bruise. We all have pains and hurts in that area, and we all have our own experience with it. But let's talk about what God has to say about the subject. We should be interested in that this morning. And here's what he has to say. Notice there are three groups of people addressed in this chapter. First, you have the married, verse 10. Unto the married, I command. Secondly, you have the unmarried and widows, verse 8. I say to the unmarried and widows. So you've got the married. That's pretty self-explanatory, isn't it? We understand who might comprise that group. What about the second group, the unmarried and the widows? Well, these are people who have been married but are not anymore. The unmarried and the widows. People who have been married but are not anymore. The widows are not anymore because of death. And the unmarried are not married anymore because, as a matter of fact, it was very common to end marriages by divorce in the first century Greek and Roman world. And then the third group he's going to address are the virgins in verse 25. He says, now concerning virgins, I have no commandment of the Lord, yet I give my judgment as one that hath obtained mercy of the Lord to be faithful. So virgins, obviously, are people who've never been married. So you have three groups of people in this chapter. The married, those who've been married but are not anymore, and then those who have never been married. Now, if you can keep that outline in your mind, this chapter is going to make a lot of sense because Paul is going to address each of their cases. He's going to talk about those who are still single and who've never been married. He's going to talk about to those who are single, who've been married in the past but are not anymore. And he's going to talk to those who are married at the moment. Notice in verses 1 and 2, the first subject Paul addresses is God's purpose for marriage. Now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife and let every woman have her own husband. Now God's purpose for marriage is a threefold purpose as it's revealed in Scripture. One of the first purposes of marriage is to mirror the relationship that exists between God and his people and between Jesus Christ and his church. Our marriages are to be microcosms of the relationship that exists between Christ and the church. Now that's what Ephesians chapter 5 teaches when he says, husbands, love your wives, even as Christ loved the church. You see how our marriage is to mirror the relationship that exists between Christ and his church? And the wife is to be subject to her husband just as the church is submissive to Jesus Christ. And he goes on to say in that chapter that this is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. In the Old Testament, God frequently says to the nation of Israel, I am married to you. He calls them his spouse, his bride. So the first purpose in marriage is that marriage is supposed to be a microcosm, a small-scale model of the relationship that exists between the Lord and his people. Secondly, marriage has been given for the purpose of solving the problem of loneliness. In Genesis 2:18, after God had created the heavens and the earth and said that everything that he had made was good and very good, there was one thing that wasn't good. You remember what it was? He said, it is not good that the man should be alone. Now, God made people as social creatures. Somebody says, I don't need anybody. I don't need anything. I just need God. Well, Adam had God in the Garden of Eden, and still the Lord said he needs a companion. It's not good that he be alone. And as a general rule, now there are a few exceptions to this rule, but as a rule, marriage, my friends, is the antidote to the plague of loneliness. It's the solution to the problem of living your life in a solitary way. And that's why in the book of Malachi chapter 2, marriage is called a covenant of companionship. Did you know, it would help us all to remember that when we are married, what we've done is we've entered into a covenant of togetherness. I've had people sit in my pastor's study before and say, preacher, my wife gets upset when I want to go bowling with the boys. And she says, he gets upset when I spend money without consulting with him. And they're just, you can tell that they're trying to each go in their own independent directions. And I have to say that when you got married, you gave up a portion of independence. Isn't that right? When people get married, they are saying that I'm no longer my own, I'm giving myself away. The apostle wants us to know that marriage is a covenant of companionship. And instead of each going in our own directions, God has joined together. He's made a one flesh relationship between husband and wife. And I think we need to do everything possible to try to maximize the spirit of togetherness and minimize any attempts of separate, independent lifestyles within the marriage relationship. Now, I just throw that out as a basic principle, because the Bible teaches that God's purpose for marriage is, first of all, to mirror the relationship that exists between Christ and the church, and secondly, His purpose for marriage is to resolve the problem of loneliness. Now, marriage then has this twofold purpose, but there's one other reason that God gave marriage, and that is as a remedy for sin and to avoid immorality. Now, we see that in our text. Notice what he says in verse 2, "Nevertheless, to avoid fornication," that is immorality, "let every man have his own wife." Now, this verse teaches us that one of God's purposes for marriage is as a remedy for sin and to avoid immorality. Hebrews 13:4 says marriage is honorable. It's not sinful. It's honorable in all, and the bed undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. You might be interested to know that verse 1 is sometimes cited to suggest that celibacy is preferable to marriage. There is an idea that has been around for centuries that if you're truly spiritual, you will deny yourself marriage and you'll live a life of total devotion to the Lord as a celibate. In verse 1, Paul's words are often cited to teach that, where he says, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Somebody says, Paul was against marriage. No, that's not what he's saying at all. If you'll notice this passage in lieu of verse 26, where Paul says in this chapter, it is good for the present distress. Notice that language. I suppose, therefore, that this is good for the present distress, I say, that it is good for a man so to be. That language, this present distress, indicates that Paul's advice to the church at Corinth was advice given to them under a special set of circumstances. That means this present crisis. I suggest that Paul is clearly addressing his remarks to this church in the context of what he calls this present distress or crisis. Let me put it in just plain, down-to-earth words. What Paul is saying here is, considering your special circumstances at the moment, my advice is that it's inexpedient for you to even think about getting married. Now, apparently they had written him this letter saying, now, we have some people in our church that are single, and they're wanting to get married. And some of our folks say, no, if you're truly devoted to the Lord, you won't need a wife. You won't need a husband. You'll just have Him. So what should we do? And Paul is looking at the big picture, and he knows that the church at Corinth is under persecution. And he's saying, from my vantage point, I would say that it's probably not the best time to think about getting married. Nevertheless, it's still lawful and right for you to do that. Does that make any sense in this passage? Paul is probably saying that it's in my opinion, it's not the best time, but I'm not saying that marriage is wrong. When he says it is good, the word, it is good for a man not to touch a woman, the word means expedient. It's inexpedient at the moment for you to think about getting married because of persecution. Let me put it like this. Obviously, marriage brings about an increase in worldly care and anxiety. I mean, you get married, you have a home, you have bills to pay, you have responsibilities to meet. With marriage comes an increase in worldly care that the person that's unmarried doesn't have to really worry about. And when we're being persecuted, like the saints at Corinth were being persecuted, Paul says, you're thinking about getting married right now? It's probably not the wisest thing to do. But he says, nevertheless, exceptional circumstances do not negate the rule that marriage is a divine institution and it's a good thing. It's not wrong. It's not sinful. In fact, God made it for man's good, and He said that it's a good thing. Now, He says, nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife. Now, notice monogamy is God's prescribed pattern for marriage. Somebody says the Bible teaches polygamy. There are some bizarre ideas floating around in this world, and one of them is that the Bible supports polygamy. And that seems to, I guess there have always been little pockets of interest in that idea. But I dare say the Bible is not in support of polygamy. In fact, the New Testament's very clear. Let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. Monogamy One man for one woman for life is God's plan and pattern for marriage. Now, I know that I'm being simplistic in saying that. I'm stating the obvious. It's a no-brainer, you say. It may be to you, but it's not in our society. Our society, our world, our culture is so mixed up on what constitutes God's pattern for marriage. Now, God gave marriage. It's His idea, and His way works. And every other way, my friends, brings heartache and misery into our lives. So the apostle is answering some questions. These people had questions. What constitutes marriage, Paul? Can't I have as many wives as I want? Can't I have as many husbands? No, Paul says, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. Somebody says, the Bible, preacher, is just too hard to understand. Can you understand that? I don't think I need to develop that thought any further. Now notice now in verses 3 through 5. In these verses, Paul now proceeds to emphasize the principle of mutual responsibility in marriage. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. Now this isn't, he's not putting one above the other here. He's putting them both on the same plane. A mutual obligation. The wife has an obligation to her husband, and the husband has an obligation to his wife. Now, I dare say that where most problems come in the marriage relationship, they come from people focusing and being concerned about their rights instead of their responsibilities. It's very common for somebody to say, I'm not having my needs met. I'm not getting what I want out of this relationship. My rights are being violated. And Paul says it's important to focus on your responsibilities, not your rights. I would challenge you today, my beloved, to think of your marriage relationships in terms of your personal obligation. Now, there's a mutual responsibility. Now, in the first century in the Corinthian church, asceticism was making inroads into the church. Asceticism is the idea that spirituality consisted in avoiding comfort and pleasure. If you were truly spiritual, you would deny yourself all comfort and pleasure. You remember that verse in Colossians that says, touch not, taste not, handle not? That was the motto of the ascetics. Even today, there is a tendency toward asceticism in the minds of some people. They say, okay, if you're truly spiritual, then you won't do this, you won't do that, you won't go here, you won't go there. That spirituality consists in avoiding comfort and pleasure. Somebody says, I'm spiritual, so I don't ever take a vacation. You say, well, if you're truly spiritual, you won't sleep over 3 hours a night, but you'll get up at 2 a.m. and spend 4 hours in prayer. You ever heard that idea? Deny yourself sleep, deny yourself dessert. Somebody says, I'm spiritual, so I only eat vegetables, but I won't eat chocolate cake. Well, I don't believe chocolate cake is the unpardonable sin. Asceticism is the idea that if you're truly spiritual, you're going to avoid comfort and pleasure. Now, this idea was making inroads into the church at Corinth. And some were suggesting that if you really wanted to be spiritual, you should separate from your marriage partner, because you don't need them anymore. You've now embraced the gospel. You've devoted yourself to Christ. And if you're truly spiritual, you don't need your marriage partner. So separate yourself and devote yourself completely to the Lord in a life of celibacy. Paul is addressing that theme now in verses 3 through 5. When he says there's only one reason to ever separate. And that should be temporary. He says, yes, it may be necessary. It may be helpful for you for temporary separation in special needs situations. But by and large, here's the rule. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence. The language suggests he has an obligation to her. Due benevolence. It's her due. And likewise, the wife to the husband. Paul is addressing this erroneous idea of asceticism by saying that separation is potentially dangerous in a marriage. Somebody says, okay, you two just need to get apart for a little while. And Paul says that's a dangerous situation, very dangerous. You better be careful before you give unbiblical advice like that to somebody. Very dangerous. Because Satan will capitalize on that kind of situation to try to undermine the integrity of the marriage relationship. Notice Paul says each partner has a mutual obligation to the other, and they must not fail to fulfill their vows to that person by withholding what is due or by separating from the other partner. What is the most destructive thing in a marriage relationship? It's the spirit of selfishness, a focus on my own needs and rights instead of being considerate of the needs and the rights of my spouse. That undermines the spirit of self-giving that is so basic and fundamental to the marriage covenant. Now, there's one exception to this general rule. After he says, let the husband render to the wife due benevolence, and likewise the wife to the husband, for the wife has not power over her own body. You've gave up those rights when you got married. Your body belongs to your husband. And likewise, the husband hath not power over his own body, but the wife. Defraud ye not one the other. Don't rob each other, is what he says. Except it be with consent. Now, there's one exception to this general rule of togetherness. And that is that temporary separation in the physical aspects of marriage is allowed, but only under certain conditions. Number one, it must be by mutual consent. He says, except it be with consent for a time. You must both agree. Secondly, it must be only for special circumstances in which there is a need to devote oneself to prayer without distraction. Now, there are special circumstances in our lives. It may be a family crisis that has reached the point of no return. I mean, it's so complex and difficult that you say, we need to both devote ourselves for a little while to fasting and prayer. Be that for a day or 2 days or whatever, we need to devote ourselves to calling upon the Lord and seeking His special assistance. It may be spiritual crises. There may be special needs. You may face a family decision that is just of unparalleled importance, and you may need for a little while to say, I need some time to myself so that I can pray. Will you agree to that? Yes, I'm going to pray too. And when both of you agree and then devote yourself for this in these special set of circumstances to prayer without being distracted by, okay, I'm responsible, I need to wait on her, and I need to minister to him. This is a special need situation. You see what he's saying here? He is describing a special situation in which you devote yourself to prayer. But then, not only must it be by consent, and it must be for a special spiritual purpose, but it must be temporary. He says, except it be with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and then come together again in a physical way, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. He's saying that you must resume physical intimacy so that the devil does not capitalize on the separation to tempt one or the other partner to sin. And Satan is so crafty, and he will do it. He will step in and try to undermine marriages. You know, the integrity of the church is built on the integrity of what? The family. Isn't that right? And the integrity of the nation is built on the integrity of the church. So the devil knows the best way to cause havoc on a collective level, nationally speaking, is to strike right at the heart of the family. If he can weaken the family, if he can, if you please, sow seeds of discord and separation in the family, in the marriage covenant, that'll affect the church and it'll affect the country. As goes the home, so goes the country.
At that point, because of the limitations of time, we will interrupt the message today and resume with the balance of this sermon on the biblical theme of marriage and divorce and remarriage on Monday's program. I hope you will join us again on Monday. As we sign off today, I would like to invite those of our listeners who are in the Coastal Carolina area to visit with us at Bethel Primitive Baptist Church in Calabash, North Carolina, this coming Sunday for public worship. You will find directions at our church website, that is bethelpbc.us. We meet at 10:30. We hope that you will come to worship with us if you're in the area. Have a good and godly day. And now until next week at this same time, may the Lord bless and keep you.